I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 24th of August. You may have seen last Sunday's New York Times front page story that centers on Milwaukee. It is titled, Segregation, the Neighbor That Won't Leave, An American Truth Endures Even for Affluent Blacks. The authors of the piece are with us, the New York Times reporters, the first hour of our program today. John Eligo is a Kansas City-based national correspondent who covers race for the New York Times, and Robert Gebeloff is a journalist with the New York Times who specializes in data analysis. The piece centers on a couple of Milwaukee families who live on the north side of Milwaukee. One of the families moved to Whitefish Bay for a while but didn't find it particularly welcoming and moved back to a mostly black neighborhood on the north side of Milwaukee. It looks at some historical factors, black families in higher income levels, according to the data that they have looked at, are more likely to live in poorer neighborhoods than even white households, making less than $25,000 a year. And segregation, particularly bad, and the lack of minorities living in suburbs around the city of Milwaukee for historic reasons that we'll be exploring during the course of this hour. Our phone number, and later in the hour, we hope to be joined by one of the people who is profiled in the Times article. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd like to read your comments, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. John, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks. And Robert, although we'll call you Bob, I believe. Hi, Bob.
Hello, how's it going?
I'm fine. How are you? Thank you so much for writing the article. We're living through difficult times here in the city of Milwaukee recently and, of course, in the past as well. This is something that probably people are unaware of that you write about, that the choices that, well, the choices obviously constrained by a legacy of racism that has been particularly strong in the Milwaukee area. But it's interesting, the segregation here and the fact that the communities are so divided that black people don't really feel very comfortable in white neighborhoods, and even if they can afford to, choose to live in areas that are black neighborhoods and maybe poor neighborhoods where there is quite a bit of crime. Is that unusual? Bob, let's start with you.
Well, it is actually not that unusual. It's just, as with all measures of segregation, more pronounced in Milwaukee. Generally, when we talk about segregation, as a demographer, what they will do is look at the overall community, in this case, the Milwaukee metropolitan area, and look at the mix of people. And so, for example, if you say in Milwaukee, for every 100 people who are either black or white, you'd expect 83 out of 100 to be white and the other 17 to be black as you went from neighborhood to neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But in Milwaukee, that is usually not the case. Most neighborhoods are either mostly black or mostly white. But then if you say, well, how much of that is due to income, and start saying, well, where do people who make X amount of money of either race live, you find that the pattern doesn't change much at all. And in some parts of the country, income does seem to ease segregation. More affluent blacks are more likely to live with affluent whites. But in many large cities, including Milwaukee and some we mentioned in the story, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, the segregation measures do not go down much.
Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that is the case, we hear from some families that you interviewed extensively. John, can you start with the story of the Sabirs?
Yeah, absolutely. There's 2 points I'd like to make first off, though. It's like, one, you have to look at this as kind of a social aspect, right? So segregated communities were created intentionally over generations.
Right.
That started back, you know, as long as the history of this country, really, where you had throughout the 20th century, you had policies that prevented black people from owning and buying houses in certain areas, whether that be certain areas in a city or in the suburbs, not getting loans, not getting, you know, investments in certain communities. So what that did is it created a social structure in which black people and white people have lived apart for generations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when that happens, you know, you that trickles down. And when you, you know, when it comes time, you know, for a family like the Sabirs, you know, when they're in their mid, late 30s, who are choosing places to live, they're going to gravitate toward the places where they have just been taught to be the most comfortable. You know, that's kind of what they've been conditioned to. That's how, you know, and just as I would expect a white family who grew up in Mequon or Whitefish Bay or something, I wouldn't necessarily expect them to suddenly become of age and then say, hey, let me move to Central City, Milwaukee, you know, because that's not how we've been trained socially. But there's also an economic element to it. When you excluded black families from housing for so long, they've not been able to accumulate that wealth. And it's that generational wealth that is built through housing, through having a house that you can pass on to generations, that then allows, you know, the generations of today to then, you know, buy up and buy into these more stable communities. So to answer your question, you know, looking at the Sabirs, this was a family where the house that they had moved back into a couple of years ago was actually a house that was bought in the mid-1950s by Joanne Sabir, who's the matriarch of the house. And she, her grandparents had bought that house back in the mid-50s when they were, you know, when they had migrated from the South. And they had, you know, they were able to, Joanne actually moved away. She actually was born in Detroit because her mother had moved away from Milwaukee when she was older. And they spent time in Detroit and in New York State. There was some time in New York City as well. And then, you know, they had moved back after September 11th, 2001, they had moved back to the city of Milwaukee. And, you know, the Sabirs had kind of lived in different parts of Milwaukee. And they came back to that neighborhood because, you know, their daughter got sick and they wanted her to be close to family. And so where's your family? Your family is located in the place that you were confined to many generations ago. So that's how they ended up finding themselves back there. And what they found when they got there was that, you know, they had actually done work in that community through a nonprofit. So they knew the community. But still, you know, there's always this kind of nervousness, reticence, because they also know some of the statistical challenges that it faces from crime and poverty and whatnot. But I think what they found there, and it wasn't a surprise to them per se, but it was just more so to feel it as a resident there. They found that, you know, this, despite all the statistical challenges that there are, that's not how it feels or plays out on the ground. Now, mm-hmm. Sure, they may hear, you know, gunshots at night every now and then. Sure, Manon, who's the Joanne's husband, he is fed up to see, like, people speeding through the stoplight right at their corner and stuff. But they also find that there's a sense of, you know, like, we're all family on this block, that they're looking out for their son, they're looking out for their daughter. So there was this really the sense of, like, inclusiveness that really helped them feel comfortable there despite the challenge.
Yeah, helping a stalled car in the middle of the night from people who might otherwise be thought of as suspicious. We're going to try to get you on another phone line, John, because your phone is breaking up here and we want to hear the words that you're saying. Let's go to you, Bob, and talk a little bit more historically here. The other thing that happened in Milwaukee is that people moved here, many African Americans from the South, for really good manufacturing jobs. And unfortunately, you had those jobs disappear almost simultaneously with the move, so that the housing that a lot of people had simply was not as valuable as it once was. So you lost money not only because you lost your job, your house lost value as well.
Yes. It is sort of, you know, in people who study segregation have noted that this is common for a lot of, I guess what you call the great migration cities, have more of this historical legacy of segregation. I would also probably factor that when, you know, the black population was growing the most in the city was at a time when segregation was more pronounced to begin with. And so the historical legacy of segregation certainly has a lot to do with this.
Mm-hmm. You also give us the figures on, I believe Milwaukee is the worst in all 50 large metropolitan cities in this country when it comes to integration of suburbs. There are very few African Americans in suburbs, and perhaps if there had been more welcoming arms back at the time when jobs were going to suburban areas, we'd have a different situation in this city today.
Yes, that's probably true. That was a study by a professor at UW-Milwaukee who basically looked at all the metropolitan areas and looked at the share of the African-American population that lived in the core city versus the suburbs. And compared to these other major metros, I believe Milwaukee had something like only 11% of its African American population was even in the suburbs to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the Sabirs for a moment, John, and find out what their response was to the fatal police shooting a couple of weeks ago in this city.
Yeah, so they were at home when that happened, and they were kind of flicking through social media to kind of, you know, take it all in. And there's this initial sense of shock, I think, that they feel, that, you know, this is happening right up the block, and no one obviously likes to see fires and likes to hear gunshots going off and things like that. But, you know, the following day, they had to go out there and kind of see it and talk to the community, because they, when I spoke with them, you know, especially Manan, he talked a lot about, he just really felt like this was sadly a long time in the making, and that there's just been so many issues of, you know, that deal with segregation, that deal with, you know, communities being policed very heavily, that deal with poverty, and then there was a sense among, that he felt a sense among Black Milwaukeeans that a lot of their concerns and whatnot and their needs and challenges have been ignored over the years. So for him, it was, you know, as tough as that was to see, it was something that in some ways felt inevitable to him, I believe. And Joanne, she actually took the children out there. They have two children, ages 14 and 12. And part of that was for them to kind of see firsthand and really kind of internalize, like, what it meant. And she, her real hope was that people could then take that energy that was expressed on the streets that night, and take it and maybe turn it toward a more positive way of effecting change, you know, try to find other avenues that you can take that energy and effect change.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't give thought to, oh, this is becoming so explosive and dangerous, maybe we should leave.
And no, I think it was the opposite for them. They were like, this is why we need to be here, because the thing I think that's important to understand about families like them is that in these communities where, you know, household incomes are very low, where there's a lot of poverty, they really, people like them, you know, they really need people who are stable, middle-class families who have not just the monetary resources, but the social resources they can bring to those communities to help, you know, in these times. Because if all the people with resources just left, you know, a lot of them have already left. So, like, I mean, there's not that many. But if there were just none at all, it almost feels like more of a hopelessness, I think, is how they feel. So mm-hmm. For them, it was like, of course, there's part of it that's uncomfortable to them, but for them, it really just solidified the importance of having families like theirs in the community.
Mm-hmm. The community in which they live is a community that used to be filled with synagogues and lots of restaurants, you write, with matzo ball soup. When did people start leaving? Would you say that it was part of white flight from Milwaukee, Bob, and when did that happen?
Yeah, it seems like right around, say, like, I believe the 50s and the 60s, there was a really rapid transformation in some of these neighborhoods. I believe the specific census tract this family lived in had only, I believe, two Black residents in one census year, and 10 years later, by 1960, it was Black majority. So I think things in Milwaukee happened pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. There also were, you highlight the story of a Black veteran who tried to build a house in Wauwatosa some years ago. Why did you include that story, and what is that story, John?
Yeah, I was going to just make one point off of what Bob just said, is that the Black migration to Milwaukee happened really later, a couple decades after the Great Migration of the South started, you know, in earnest, and, you know, 20s, 30s, and whatnot. It didn't really take off in Milwaukee until really a little bit after the 50s, but then after the 1960s is when it really took off. So that's when you really saw a lot of these communities changing, once a lot of Black people started to come to the city. And the story of Wauwatosa, of Zeddy Hyler, he was the first Black person to attempt to build a house in Wauwatosa. And it was in the mid, it was in 1955, I believe, is when he built it there. And there were twice it was vandalized. And then one night he sat out there, he got some of his friends, and they kind of sat there with their rifles just waiting for vandals to return, you know, to kind of scare them off. And I thought it was important to show that, because it shows, like, really where the struggle among Black people living in Milwaukee really started, you know, right around the time that you saw a lot of black people coming to Milwaukee. And I think, you know, that is seen as kind of one of those times when, you know, maybe this was a time for a turning point to happen, that, you know, someone stood up, they fought back, and they were able to build their house there and live there. You know, he lived there until 2004 when he died. But really, it in some ways only kind of highlighted and exacerbated the tensions that were in the community that people would then have to follow, you know, whether it be Father Grappi or Vail Phillips in the years that followed, you know, or even as recently as, you know, last year with John Henson, the basketball player from the Milwaukee Bucks, who had the incident at the jewelry store in Whitefish Bay. So for me, it was like, you know, you look at that story and you think, you know, it's kind of hopeful to see that this man was able to successfully build his home there. But then it also kind of just speaks to the challenges that were, it was almost a precursor to the challenges that were to come in the generations and decades that followed.
Yeah. And you may want to highlight the challenges that Taj Sabir faced when he was invited to a white classmate's home in Wauwatosa.
Yeah. He went over to play with one of his friends, and then somehow the conversation went around to, you know, going outside and playing with, like, Nerf guns or water guns or something like that. And, you know, they, Taj had kind of brought up to his friend, because Taj is 12 years old, that, hey, you know, he thought of Tamir Rice and what happened in the Tamir Rice situation. And, like, you know, it's not necessarily that safe for me as a young black boy to be outside playing with a toy gun. And he kind of brought up the issue of police officers and how they treat black people. And in Taj's opinion, he did not feel that all police officers had his best interest in heart, and he expressed that to his friend and his friend's mother, who was there. And the friend's mother, who was white, they became kind of concerned that Taj was talking, you know, like if all cops were bad. So she kind of, you know, made that point to him, no, not all cops are bad. And she ended up calling Taj's parents and letting them know, you know, that this had happened. And for me, it just really kind of shows, you know, these multiple worlds that
right.
A lot of times middle-class black people have to live in, you know. It's on the one hand, you're at, you know, you're in your community where people kind of get it culturally, and then yet, you know, you might want to, you might be concerned about the performance of the schools there, so you send your children, in this case, Taj goes to a private Catholic school, and it's majority white students and whatnot, so you send them to a different world, and there, the perceptions of what happens in the world are very much different than what they see on their block in their own household.
Mm-hmm. Well, when they grow up, they're going to be able to navigate the whole world, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, that's the thing, you know, that's the hope, right, that, you know, when you get older, that you would then, you know, having had experiences with people of different races, that would then help you navigate your way through the world, you know, that's obviously the hope, you know, and the trick about it is getting your... It's for, I think, these middle-class black families, it's getting their children through it in a way where they learn to appreciate who they are and who their communities are,
mm-hmm.
while also understanding, like, how the larger world works and the challenges that you have to get through there. Because you don't want them to be in that much of a challenged environment to where, you know, like, they can't, you know, they just feel like they break down and they can't make it. And this is something that Joanne Sabir had spoken to, was that, you know, you face challenges wherever you go. Like, so you're in your own neighborhood, yeah, there is more crime. You know, the schools might not be as well resourced, so you don't, you know, get the same training and equipment at school. So you have to figure out how to get over that challenge, right? And then you go to you know, a white suburb, you live in there or something like that. Then there's challenges in terms of, like, socially. How do you get people to understand you? Do you feel kind of on the outside looking in? So there's challenges there. So there's challenges in both areas, is what Joanne talked about, and it's really about learning how to navigate and manage those challenges.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. Many of you saw the New York Times last Sunday and said, oh, this is about Milwaukee. The title of the article is Segregation, the Neighbor That Won't Leave, An American Truth Endures Even for Affluent Blacks. Our guests are the authors of the piece, and they are John Eljigo, a Kansas City-based national correspondent for The Times. He covers race, and Robert Gebeloff, who's a journalist with The Times who specializes in data analysis. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. When it is said that we are the most segregated segregated community. When you look at the Milwaukee County region of any place in the country, this article explains historical reasons for that to be the case and lingering reasons why that is the case in 2016. We'll be with your phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone calls for John and Bob, 800-486-8655. We start with Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I think many of us who participated in the Groppy Fair Housing marches with the NAACP are depressed. This was during the 70s and 80s. Nothing has improved since that time. The north side of Milwaukee is a ghetto. There's no transportation out to employment. Employment has left urban Milwaukee. So the ghetto is more or less a concentration camp without barbed wire. It is completely explainable to me why there is lots of trouble in that area. But it is the responsibility of the male white community, and that's where the responsibility lies. I don't see much of an opportunity to change the environment there.
And it's the responsibility of the male white community to do what, Richard?
Well, to solve this problem. They are the ones who created the problem. They are the ones who have the means, the money, and the power to change. You cannot change. The victims ordinarily, in a situation of this sort, cannot change their environment.
Thank you very much for your call. Bob, let's start with you, and I want John's response, too.
Well, I mean, just on a numeric perspective, I mean, the reason people look at segregation by metropolitan areas is the assumption that if people live in an area, they can live somewhere in the area and work someplace in the area. So the idea that, you know, transportation systems and employment opportunities have something to do with this is true. I mean, in more integrated areas, people are able to have more choices just based on, you know, where they can work and getting to work. So,
John?
Yeah, I mean, I would say a couple things. One, this is kind of the challenge, right? Because the way that Richard described it, it's just like, you know, the complete, you know, just like a war zone up there. It's almost like, you know, what Donald Trump has been saying recent days regarding, you know, black communities. But the reality is it's somewhat more of a nuanced reality, I think, for people who live there. While, you know, while of course nobody likes the challenges that you know, of having blight and of having, you know, other issues up there that make it not as livable, I think the frustration of people who live in those communities is that it's cast with a broad brush as just being these terrible places where, you know, you can't even walk down the street and without worrying about getting a bullet to the head. That's not how people up there think. You know, a lot of people up there find community among each other. They find, you know, friendships. They find relationships. And even like Kathleen, like you were talking about earlier, the example in the story about when Manon's car stalled in the middle of the night. It was some of the young men who people will look at and say, oh, those are suspicious guys hanging out on the block. They came out there and helped them, you know. So I think, you know, for people up there, you know, one of the coping mechanisms that I found from several of the middle-class black families that I interviewed, because we interviewed probably more than two dozen, you know, there were only a couple in the article, but we interviewed more than two dozen. One of the coping mechanisms, in a way, is to basically be friendly and get to know all of your neighbors, because it, you know, once you get to know people on a one-to-one level, then you're less likely to be someone who's targeted for something, you know, because what do we know about violent crime? It's oftentimes it's targeted, it's people who know each other and things like that. So if you really show that you are, you know, there for everyone, like Manon, when he walks around the community, he's always kind of hassling the young boys, saying, hey, get your resume together, you know, I know someone who got jobs and things like that. He's always trying to, you know, push them to really kind of stay on the straight and narrow. And yeah, so I think it's kind of a tough thing, right? You know, to on the one hand, you know that there are problems there statistically, but on the other hand, how do you not then paint the whole place with a broad brush? You know, so it's got to be something in the middle. And this is second point about, you know, who has to who is responsible for solving the problem. Undoubtedly, you know, the white power structure of state, county, city governments does have a play a large role. Obviously, you know, you rely on a lot of funding from Madison and whatnot to fix these communities. But, you know, I guess on the other hand, you know, a theme that I think, you know, you can speak to broadly in this, you know, social justice movement that's been going on for the past couple of years is also about black empowerment. And so while, yes, there is a need for resources and legislation and things that would help black communities, and those resources and legislation are largely controlled by white people, I think the last thing black communities want to hear is that they need white saviors. They just want the tools to empower themselves to make their communities better. I think that's what people there really want. They say, hey, if you give us a fair shot, we can make our communities better.
Mm-hmm. And Joanne had an interesting response to the riots that took place a week ago Saturday in Milwaukee when she talked about the power that she saw and how it could be used. What did she say, John?
Yeah, she talked about, you know, seeing the power that those young people had while they were, you know, on the streets and kind of, you know, doing what they were doing, was that it was like almost limitless power. Like, no one could stop them, you know, no one was stepping in to stop them. And she was like, you know, if we take that attitude that, you know, no one can stop me, and let's use that toward, you know, maybe a more positive outlet for affecting change. She just thought about, like, how powerful could that be if you have take that attitude, like, no one can stop me and I can do this, and then put that towards something positive. I think that was really her message.
Richard, thanks for your call. James in Menominee, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
All right, James, how are you?
Great show, Kathy, and I always look forward to you. I'm an outside sales, so I get to listen to you a lot. But I have, this is more of a comment than anything. I'm a Milwaukee native. I'm a graduate of Milwaukee Public Schools and a former teacher in Milwaukee Public Schools.
Mm.
And this whole situation that has reared its ugly head, it really saddens me, and a little bit angers me a little bit at times, but I think the public perception with the, oh, the way you said something about it was in the New York Times, that people that know I'm from Milwaukee would say, well, why do we even go there? Isn't it like the whole city is just a war zone? And it has a bad reputation that way. And I tell people, no, it's a wonderful place to go. I even have a son that attends UWM, and I love to go down there, and we go all over the city together, and I just still have family there. I love being there. It seems like the image of the city has really taken a hit.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's not the New York Times that is doing that, because this article looks at people who are staying in the neighborhoods and wonderful things that are happening in the neighborhoods. But, Bob, it is true that when you have riots, and this has been true in Milwaukee for a long time, there are people, I know people who live in the suburbs who are terribly afraid of coming to downtown Milwaukee because something's going to happen. You paint this whole area with this broad brush. Not that there aren't significant problems here, but the response in many ways, this is just not a safe place to be at all.
Well, what's interesting to me is in many cities that have also grappled with this, at least parts of the cities in recent years have sort of turned it around, where for whatever perceptions have changed and more people of all races have thought being in the city is better than, say, being out in the suburbs. And so it raises a whole other set of issues with gentrification and such. But, you know, to a certain extent, that has not happened as much in Milwaukee, I think.
Mm-hmm. John, you want to respond?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the first thing that comes to mind when I, you know, hear about that, I think the phrase, don't hate the player, hate the game. Like, so there's a lot of people, black people I talk to in Milwaukee, who love their city. You know, you like the player, you like the city, but it's the game, it's the structure,
mm-hmm.
it's the perpetuation of a certain system. That's what people hate, you know, and I found this, you know, I kind of find this reaction when I, not just looking at Milwaukee, but other cities, and even, for instance, when there was a lot of that unrest on college campuses last year over kind of racial issues, I found a lot of, like, white alumni or white students stepping up and saying, oh, our school isn't racist, this isn't bad school, and this isn't a bad place and all that, our school. And then a lot of black students weren't as quick to come to the defense. A lot of black alums were not as quick to come to the defense of their institutions. Because I think for black people who I have talked to, there's more of a sense of we can like love our heritage of where we came from, our cities, our schools and whatnot, but we can still hate some of the bad elements, the structure that kind of keeps us marginalized about it. And so that's kind of how I look at that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, James, for the call. Let's go to Dave in Madison. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, Dave.
It's
Kathleen. Dave. Hi.
Yeah, my question is...
I'm sorry, Dave, your phone is lousy. Can you give us a call back? Because we can't hear what you're saying. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen and guests. I just came off a several-week trip to Northern California where family and friends are, and I'm sort of struck by how multicultural California is and also how youthful it is. They know there's an aging demographic in Wisconsin, and I don't know if this is even a useful observation, but I just don't think young people, particularly young people in my family and my circle, their circles that they bring into the family, I don't think they want to live in a place that's largely segregated or has the patterns that Milwaukee has. That's just an observation. I'm wondering if your guests also see that young people sort of gravitate to places and societies where they mix it up a lot more than in the Milwaukee area.
That's an interesting observation. Bob, what do you say?
I think I haven't specifically studied this, but I would agree that, I mean, what I have studied is that the areas that are less segregated tend to be newer places where younger people are moving to. And then within metropolitan areas, the places that are integrated and are successful integrated neighborhoods within communities tend to be places with younger people. So I would say there is probably something to that.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things, it's not a real focus of the article, but I've lived in the city for a long, long time. The other thing that happened is that there were some efforts with the desegregation of Milwaukee public schools many years ago to make some of the schools specialty schools in the arts or for college-bound young people, so that there was a hope that white kids would move into these schools, and they did, in not huge numbers, but there was some of that that took place, and a lot of that has stalled, so you have very little integration of a lot of the schools. So the very thing that Rich is talking about isn't happening because the neighborhoods are so segregated and thus the schools are so segregated, John.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think people usually follow schools oftentimes when they look for places to live. And, that's kind of one of the eternal challenges. I mean, you have the big, disputes over, these specialty schools, be it charter or magnets and whatnot, and how they impact, public schools, whether they only serve, what slice of this population they actually help. I think to the point of wanting more multicultural society, I think it's, maybe I'm journalistically skeptical. I want to see, this younger generation that is supposedly more inclusive and more accepting, I want to see how they are in 20, 30 years. I want to see how they are when they actually have to choose where they send their kids to school, right?
Right.
I want to see how they are where they have to choose where to build a house. But, because what the studies have shown is that, historically, white people will prefer to live in communities that are predominantly white, while people of color will prefer communities that are more racially mixed. That's kind of, what many studies have kind of shown that. They have come up with that conclusion. So for me, it's still, maybe there is kind of this kind of youthful utopia or youthful naivete, you can even say, where it's like, I'll be friends with anyone. But it's one thing to want to be friends with someone. It's another thing to want to sit your house next to them, want right. to send your kids to the same school as them, want to spend money with them, want to break bread with them. It's one thing, to want to go to the bar with them on the weekend, right? That's totally different than where you plop yourself, where you plop your body in your house, and where you invest your money.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the sad things about what happened in the Sherman Park area, because the Sherman Park area historically has been, many people lived there just because they wanted to have a community that was racially mixed, and it's a very, very mixed area. And there are so many benefits to living in that kind of community. And then look what happens. It just makes a lot of people very sad.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing about Sherman Park, I mean, you look at that, it's look at the housing stock. I mean, you have really nice kind of larger brick, you know, two-story houses there. You have the kind of this, you know, nice mix of kind of more integration. I'd probably still say it's relatively not maybe as integrated as maybe it should be. But, yeah, I mean, that's it's always surprising when things happen in communities like that.
Yeah. As you look at the country, what Rich was talking about, are there certain cities, I'm sure there are, that are doing, because we're at the bottom of the list, what metropolitan areas are faring much better than we are when it comes to integration, when it comes to revitalizing of all communities? Bob?
Well, if you look at, in general, the places that are more integrated, I mean, there's no place, I mean, to be honest, there's no place that you would say is 100% integrated. I mean, this plays out to a certain extent all over. But generally speaking, if you look at some of these fast-growing places in the South, like Charleston or in North Carolina or Charlotte or Atlanta, there is still pockets where it's mostly white and mostly black, but there is a higher percentage of integrated communities. And I mean, the standard explanation is these places, I mean, to a certain extent, you know, are newer communities and are growing in a way that is more integrated.
Let's go to Jackie and Drummond next. Hello, Jackie.
Hi, I'm just about pulling off the road. This is a very interesting discussion that kind of segues into the book, The Warmth of Other Suns, and I was wondering if your guests are familiar with that book. It was written quite a long time ago, but it traces about three families during the Great Migration during the 40s and 50s, and I think they go to California, Detroit, and Chicago. And it is right on with your discussion of Milwaukee. You
know, yeah,
they met when they came to the towns at first, successful with factory jobs, and then all the factory jobs left. So I think that, and I don't know if Milwaukee was considered a state, you know, in the Great Migration, but if people are interested in more about this, it certainly gives you an insight into what has happened in the long-term range that segregation plays.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. I'm sure you're both very familiar with it.
Yeah, I was actually discussing it with one of my colleagues a couple weeks ago, and it was almost like, you know, the interesting way to look at it is through the context of it shows black people as really being immigrants in their own country, right? You know, so you go from the South to the North, and here you are. You're like an immigrant. You might still have family in the South. You got to send money back, you know, back home to the South. And, you know, that's really what we've seen play out. And the interesting thing that I want to, like, explore further myself, you know, I had a discussion with a demographer about this the other day, is that, you know, in some ways, you know, there's still some of that, you know, kind of resegregation happening, you know, as people move. Now it's not maybe from the South to the North, but now it's maybe from a city to a suburb, or, you know, in some places it's more moving from suburbs back to the city. What kind of impact that has in terms of displacing or dispersing racial populations that are there? Because there's some sense that some of our suburbs are now becoming resegregated from what they were in the past.
Let's take more phone calls in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. We also want to highlight, we had hoped that this guest could be with us. Another person highlighted in the Times piece is a family that moved from the north side of Milwaukee to Whitefish Bay and then moved back. So we'll hear that story and why the family decided to move back. We're talking this hour of the program with the authors of a piece that appeared in the New York Times front page story Sunday, August 21st, Segregation, The Neighbor That Won't Leave. And the authors of the piece are with us, John Elgo and Robert Jebeloff. And we'll return to you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. And Steve in Danbury. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Steve.
My wife and I have had the opportunity several times over the last few years to travel across the South. So I'm kind of piggybacking on what your guest said just a minute ago. But we're always struck, especially traveling north to south through Mississippi and going through some of the medium-sized cities there like Tupelo and Meridian, by how integrated these cities are compared to the cities of the North. You see people socializing together, working together, living together. And I think we've tended for a lot of years to kind of look down our nose at the South in terms of integration and segregation issues. But I think they've got it over us. And I don't know what the magic formula is. I worked with youth in the Twin Cities for a long time, and that exposed to me how segregated Minneapolis-St. Paul is, too, really not too far behind Milwaukee in that respect. I think it's really the responsibility, not to say that white people can change this, but I think it's the responsibility of white folks to reach out to our non-white neighbors whenever we can and begin to make relationships where there aren't relationships. I think it has to happen on a person-to-person level to kind of break down what has built up here in these northern cities over the years.
Thank you, Steve. Bob, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think most of my, this is like kind of one of the ironies is that, you know, who would think that the South, after with the history of this country, would turn out to be in the modern era, have many more integrated communities. And, you know, it's been described that, you know, northern racism is different than southern racism. But, you know, whatever the form of northern racism is still in many ways playing out today, or even the legacy of it is still playing out today in these cities.
Well, the Confederate flag, though, is still flying in a lot of places in the South, isn't it? I mean, it's going down, too, but there still are lots of bumper stickers, et cetera.
Right, for sure. But in terms of the housing patterns and where people live, that is, you know, it is really starkly different. If you look at the map and look at the segregation levels in the cities, almost all of the most integrated cities are, you know, in the South.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Let's. We had hoped that she could be with us, but she's in a meeting. We didn't get to the part of the story with the family that lived on the north side, had it with the neighborhood that was too violent, and moved to Whitefish Bay, which is 90% white, and didn't have the best of experiences. John?
Yeah, so this is the Brookins family. They had lived in north side of Milwaukee. They bought a house back, you know, I think it was shortly before, right around the house, time of the housing crash. Then, you know, the housing bubble crashed, and, you know, people started to move out. Crime started to rise in the neighborhood. They really started to see a rapid deterioration. And, you know, their son was robbed once, and they, you know, someone across the street from them might have gotten shot in the face, and then there was another neighbor who got robbed at gunpoint while she had her two toddlers with her. And they just decided, you know, we got to get out of here, you know. And their daughter had been using, had been getting bussed out to Whitefish Bay as part of the Chapter 220 program for school there. So their daughter, who's now 9, and she, you know, she was younger at the time, but she'd been getting bussed out there for a while, so they said, yeah, why don't we move out there so she can stay in that district, and then we can get our son, who's now 18, and we could get him into, you know, into that school district as well, because he wasn't able to get in through 220. And so they, you know, they looked in Whitefish Bay, and this is kind of, you know, one of the important points, I think, of why this continues to happen is time and again you see that housing stock and housing values in black neighborhoods will drop and they won't rebound, they won't recover, because, you know, once a lot of these, you know, once the downturn happens, a lot of abandonment, there's a lot of blight, there's a lot of crime that takes over, that depresses housing values, and it's much more affected in predominantly black neighborhoods than white neighborhoods where you might have housing values bounce back. So they had no equity in their house, basically, that they had bought years earlier, so they weren't able to use that equity to then buy up and get into a more stable community. Instead, they found themselves, having owned a home in the city, they had to go and pay $450 more a month to rent a home in Whitefish Bay. So they made that move, and then they went out there, and they were out there for several years. And, you know, I don't know if you want me to tell you more about this.
Sure, go ahead. What they experienced.
So while they were out there, I mean, I'd say overall, generally, they liked, you know, they enjoyed their time there. You know, they loved that they could walk everywhere, because in their old neighborhood you couldn't walk. They could walk up to Sendik's food market and, you know, get whatever. They had live lobster in the food market, and they have, you know, a forest in there and all these, like, fancy stuff. And then there's a Starbucks close by. There was just all these amenities they could walk to. they found that really nice, you know, that they could get out a lot. And they just, I remember they said when they first moved in, they felt, you know, we can feel safe with our daughter just playing out in the street and on the sidewalk. It feels a little bit safer for us. So they were very appreciative of that. So, and that's an important thing to note here, is that this is not the time of, like, necessarily this really hostile, overt, you know, burn crosses in your yard type racism. But what they did experience was this kind of sense, I've always called it like a sense of otherness,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, the Sabirs, they got to their community and people are like, hey, how's your daughter doing? How's your son doing? You know, when's the basketball game? And things like that. They didn't feel that, like, warm embrace when they got there. Now, that doesn't mean that people are, you know, some sort of, you know, like they hate black people and they don't want them in their neighborhood. It just made them feel like they were just not, you know, part of the community. They weren't getting invited to the cookouts. You know, they just didn't feel this kind of warm embrace.
Right.
And I think that that's kind of what was left with them. And then the father, Zantani, he'd gotten pulled over by the cops several times. You know, one time it was like right in front of his house. So that happened, and, you know, that kind of irked him a little bit. He said what irked him more was when he was taking his daughter around on her bicycle one day, and then he saw a mother, their white children were playing outside, and the mother brought the white children in as they were coming down the street. And again, you know, was that perception? Was that reality? It kind of doesn't matter. When you're in that situation, you can already tell that you're different than most other people around you. That's what you see, and that's what they perceived. And, you know, and stuff like that made him feel really kind of somewhat uncomfortable, you know. So not that they hated it there, not that they didn't like it, because they actually did like it, but it's that, you know, that challenge of how do I belong and how do I fit in that really kind of never left their minds. And so they, you know, an opportunity presented itself for them to move back in the city, and they took it. You know, they were renting, they got to rent another house from someone they knew, and it was cheaper. And they said, hey, you know, even though the community statistically is not as nice, even though we can't walk to places anymore, we have to drive everywhere now, for them, it was kind of worth the change.
Thank you so much, Steve, for your call. Let's go to Warren in Woodruff next. Hi, Warren.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I was telling the person I spoke to earlier that I'm in Woodruff, and I've been living here for a bunch of years now, but I'm from Chicago, the most racially segregated, according to the newspapers. And I went to high school with black people, but I think we're all racist at heart. We all want to live in a neighborhood that we trust everybody and know nobody hates us for the color of our skin or our religion, politics, and that's something I see from this. And I'm 65,
mm-hmm.
and I see this racial divide widening today.
Mm. Do white people want to live with white people, Bob?
Yeah, and one way that's been measured is, you know, one of the studies we linked to in the story is, you know, people do these sort of perception tests and try and ascertain, like, what would be a desirable neighborhood, say, you'd want to live in. And they're able to discover that, you know, when they do these tests on, you know, white respondents, they almost idealize neighborhoods that are all white, whereas non-white respondents are more likely to idealize diverse neighborhoods. It's really complicated, because even in places that are diverse, I mean, what they're finding too is, say, in a school district, like, people want to be in a diverse community, want to live with neighbors who are diverse, but then the school districts often end up within the school being segregated, say, with the white students in gifted classes and the non-white students not in gifted classes. And that seems to, you know, again, be what the white parents seem to prefer, or how it just ends up playing out. So it's you know, very, you know, difficult, you know, on many levels.
Yeah. And so the story goes on. Thank you both so much for highlighting this city, which is having a hard time entering a period of self-reflection and, I hope, action fairly soon. John, thank you. Bob, thank you so much for being with us, for your work.
Thank you for having us.
the piece, in case you missed it, we have linked the whole article on our Facebook page, Segregation, the Neighbor That Won't Leave. John Elligo is based in Kansas City. He covers race for the New York Times. Bob Jebeloff does data analysis for the New York Times, and they co-authored this piece. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing the hour and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and next our guests will come from the wonderful, beautiful, and renovated Milwaukee Art Museum.